While the battle to remove President Donald Trump from office following last week's insurrection of the Capitol continues in Washington, D.C., another important political story is playing out in the American South. Last week, after months of fierce campaigning, the Democrats took control of the U.S. Senate, and they did it in Georgia, a state that's been reliably red for almost two decades.
We were told that we couldn't win this election.
Whether you were for me or against me, I'll be for you.
We proved that with hope, hard work, and the people by our side, anything is possible.
It is with humility that I thank the people of Georgia for electing me to serve you in the United States Senate.
That's Raphael Warnock, Georgia's first black senator, and John Ossoff, who also beat the Republican incumbent in the special election. Much of the credit for Ossoff's and Warnock's wins can be attributed to large and sustained grassroots organizing led by Stacey Abrams, the former minority leader of the Georgia House of Representatives. And much of that work was focused on turning out voters of color.
Georgia deserves real leaders, men and women who will stand up for all Georgians and who will do what's right for our people, especially for our military families.
Is the Ossoff-Warnock win a fluke, or does it make Georgia a bellwether for the political future of the rest of the South? That's what we're talking about. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Brandon Miller is a Democratic Party strategist and a partner at Chisholm Strategies, a political consulting firm based in Jackson, Mississippi. Brandon, welcome to the show.
Hey, great to be with you.
Anoa Changa is a freelance journalist based in Atlanta and the host of the politics podcast, The Way with Anoa. Anoa, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And Ested Herndon is a national political reporter at The New York Times. Ested, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with you, Ested. We're talking about the South today, and there's a moment where there was this interesting juxtaposition, I'll call it that, during the Capitol insurrection last week, where there was one of the insurrectionists was walking through the halls of Congress holding the Confederate flag. And yet we have the state of Georgia with two Democrat wins. And this juxtaposition, where does that tell us about where we are today with the South? I mean, it just felt really intense to see that.
Yeah, I think the scenes that we saw last week are kind of an encapsulation of the real split screen we're seeing in American politics right now. You have a real rising multicultural tide, a kind of changing electorate that's particularly been true in Georgia. That's kind of emerged as the state that represents the changing South, the new South, and the kind of coalition that was building there that helped elect these senators. Not only does that include the kind of base of Democrats in the South, which has been Black people and a rise in that vote share, but it also includes kind of new communities coming to the state. You have a rise in Latino voters, AAPI voters, and a break from Republicans among the kind of white suburbs. That coalition together helped elect folks. But at the same time, you have a backlash to that multiracial democracy that has been fueled by President Trump. That is a white grievance-driven mob violence that we have seen across the country, but made its way to Washington last week. Both those tides are very real in this country, and going to forward as a democracy, the kind of open question we wrote last week in the Times was, whose democracy is it? And will the kind of militia, the insurrectionists respect the kind of core tenets that we've come to know about democracy that much of Georgia represented?
Anoa, how much has the Georgia demographics changed? And what I mean by that is, we're talking about grassroots organizers and their role, particularly Stacey Abrams, in securing Democratic wins. And we're thinking Black women, Latinos, a lot of the folks that Stead mentioned, Asian American voters. So how important and how much has the landscape of Georgia changed in the past couple of years?
Mm-hmm. I appreciate the question. Yeah, I mean, we're seeing a real increase, not just in raw demographic numerical changes, but in terms of the actual investing in turning out particular voters, and not just showing up like we see in traditional political cycles, you know, a few weeks before an election, but having that deep year-round organizing and engagement by civic engagement, by voting rights orgs, regardless of what type of election cycle it is, or as the case right now, today we start our legislative cycle here in Georgia. We also see, you know, we do see an influx of folks coming into the state who are, you know, more diverse. But we also are seeing, you know, new voters, new Americans in, you know, some areas like Gwinnett County in particular, that are really taking root and taking hold as a part of the democratic process here. And it's also being reflected in terms of the people that are being sent to the Georgia State House in terms of those who have been elected either in the Senate or in the House of Representatives. But to Ested's point earlier about, you know, Black voters and having a larger share, that investment is also not being solely concentrated in the Atlanta metro area. We saw amazing turnout in a runoff in rural areas of Black voters, of other voters of color as well. But when you see someplace like Cuthbert, Georgia, like Randolph County, which made news in 2018 for being targeted for the closure of 7 out of 9 polling locations in a predominantly Black county, to see that resilience now in this election cycle that we just had in terms of that voter turnout is really amazing, on top of the fact that Southwest Georgia in particular has been hard hit by the COVID-19 pandemic and rural hospital closures. So people are tying these issues directly to the political process and seeing that their engagement is also a part of how they can turn some of these situations around.
Brandon, you're the political strategist here, and I'm wondering if you can give us an assessment about how the Democrats, in particular, generally get the state. They've struggled in the South for many, many decades. And, you know, with the occasional election here and there, with the occasional win, largely the South has been considered a Republican stronghold. What did the Democrats do right this time?
First of all, Georgia is a clear case of a state where demographics were, in fact, destiny, right? Democrats have been looking at Georgia for years now. Obama came within about 5 points of winning the state in 2008. Cook and RCP listed their gubernatorial and Senate races in 2014 as toss-ups. And there was some discussion of whether the Clinton campaign should invest there in 16. So, and all that makes sense. Georgia is a state with the second largest African-American population in the country. The Asian and Latino shares of the electorate have tripled since 2008. And then, of course, like Ested was saying, you've got this large urban and suburban white population who are exactly the sort of voters who swung from Romney to Clinton in 2016. So Democrats had all of the ingredients to make win happen in Georgia, but they've not been able to cook one up, so to speak, right? And that's where organizations, most notably Stacey Abrams' Fair Fight, stepped in and were able to register hundreds of thousands of voters and move them to the polls. And so, you know, the dynamic that I think gets talked about less often is actually how close Republicans came to foiling that plan with their own registration and turnout efforts. There were 19 counties in Georgia, mostly in northern Georgia and exurban Atlanta, that had more voters show up to the polls this year than were registered in 2016. And Trump won those counties 71-28. And, you know, overall, Trump increases vote share by about 18%. So in general, both sides have just done a phenomenal job of registering and turning out new voters. And the question in the runoff was, which side's going to do a better job of keeping those voters energized? And Democrats obviously won that contest.
They won that contest, Brandon, but they won it with a very thin margin. And I guess, Ested, I'm wondering if you, based on what Brandon just said, as far as, you know, the Republican turnout, they didn't slouch there either. The margins of the victory here were extraordinarily thin. What does that tell you, Ested, about what this could signal for the future? And I know it's hard to make predictions here, but are we going to see more tight races coming up, do you think?
Well, I think that that's the nature of a purple state, which is now what Georgia clearly is. You know, just because Joe Biden and now the Democratic senators have won there does not mean it has gone from, you know, red to blue. It means, you know, it means that this state is one that's really up for grabs and that can kind of swing with every election, even as the demographic changes and the other changes continue. And I think that that's what we should come to expect. But I think on the Republican side, there's a lot of warning signs. This is certainly a race that they came in to it favored. You had David Perdue not even really campaign in the runoff, not debate his opponent because of that level of confidence. Obviously, he was ahead of Ossoff in the November races. But you just do not have people who, I think the big takeaway from the Republican side is that without Donald Trump on the ballot, you are not seeing those turnout that you need to overcome the losses in urban areas. And so while Donald Trump himself can really increase Republican turnout in some rural areas that can overwhelm the backlash to him in some states. We did not see that in Georgia on the presidential level in November. And then the chaos that was caused in the runoff certainly affected Republicans statewide. And so Georgia remains a state with a lot of Republicans, yes. But I would say that the signs coming out of the runoff are not positive for that state, even though they did have some down ballot success.
I want to talk about that down ballot success. And Noah, like, we're really focused on the big the Ossoff and Warnock wins here. But how have Democratic candidates fared in other down ballot races?
Yeah, I mean, in the runoff, there was so much attention on the two Senate seats that folks often overlook the fact that we had a third race in the runoff, the Public Service Commission, which had a very interesting turnout with the incumbent having actually a high. The Republican incumbent actually had a higher vote share overall than either of the two U.S. Senate candidates, but the Democratic candidate on that ticket did not really meet the same level of threshold and success. And so it raises a couple of different questions and issues when you have this type of strategic, short span of getting people out to vote in terms of making sure folks understand everything that's on the ballot. During the general election, however, we did see some really amazing wins happening in Gwinnett County. You saw elections of, folks to county commission. You saw folks, I think Democrats control the county commission now for the first time in several decades. You saw folks being added to the school board. The sheriff in both Gwinnett County and Cobb County, Democrats took both of those seats. And both were people who pledged to do away with their 287G agreements. And the Gwinnett County Sheriff has already done away with that.
And Noah, what's a 287G agreement, just so our listeners
know? Thank you. 287G, just thinking about it, it's so commonplace to just talk about it in my head. But 287G is an agreement between law enforcement and ICE. And so this was something that organizations like Mahinte, like GLAR, Latino-based organizations, BAJI, which is Black Alliance for Justice, for Just Immigration. These are things that organizers have been really advocating for in terms of having, we've had this wave of more progressive minded DAs coming through. Folks have started doing that same shift with sheriffs. And so we saw this coming in, not saying that people are super progressive, but they were willing to at least adopt some policies and agendas that communities have really been pushing under the guise of we want to keep our community safe, but that means everyone in the community, and having unnecessary interactions with law enforcement could put people in danger of deportation or detention. And so that was really significant. Also, the new DA in Athens County, Deborah Gonzalez, who was the first Latina DA in the state, but also had to sue the government multiple times, the Secretary of State, who everyone has been praising wrongfully, but also the governor in terms of being able to even have her race. So Deborah Gonzalez fought an amazing race to be able to be elected to that position in DA. So we've seen amazing, down ballot wins all up and down the ballot. And that's a testament to the year-round organizing. Yes, the demographics have been trending a certain way, but people have to do that work to educate and inform voters to make sure that they're actually turning out. And that is something that's being done across the South, not just here in Georgia.
Brandon, you are based in Mississippi. We're over here talking about Georgia, but does the win, and you said that Republicans did turn out strongly for Donald Trump. Trump will not be running, at least in the next 2 years, let's say, for the next round of big elections that we're going to see for the midterms. What do you see as far as these wins in Georgia? Are they a bellwether for the broader South politically?
So there's obviously something to learn in the methods that organizers in Georgia use to register and turn out new voters. But in a sort of twisted way, the win in Georgia actually makes things look even bleaker for a state like Mississippi, in the sense that it came without any improvement for Democrats in rural areas. So you have this combined problem for Democrats of population loss in rural Black communities and a shift away from Democrats among rural white voters. So Warnock, for example, got 500,000 more votes in the runoff than Obama got in the 2012 general, and he improved on his net vote share by 8 or 9 points statewide. But 70% of that raw vote increase came from just 6 counties, all in metro Atlanta. And so when you talk about the drop in the rural vote is obviously less important in a state like Georgia, which has one of the largest cities in the country, in Atlanta, but it's critical in other states. So whereas only, a quarter of Georgia's population lived in rural areas as of the 2010 census, half of Mississippi's population was still in rural areas. So if Georgia's win was only possible because of a dynamic, growing, diversifying urban and suburban population, that's something other states just can't recreate. Now, that being said, if I'm the Democratic Party of Texas, which has four of the 11 largest cities in the country, or one of the Carolinas, which are closer to Georgia in terms of the urban-rural divide, I can look at Georgia for clues. But even then, you know, Fair Fight was able to do what it did because it raised about $90 million. That's a lot of money. And so if the lesson here is, you know, hey, other southern states, you too can increase Democratic turnout for the low, low price of $90 million, I think the response would probably be, well, duh. Nationally, Democrats, you know, they need to learn, don't stop investing in places like Georgia, in places like South Carolina, where Democrats were disappointed, right, after losing that Jamie Harrison race. But this isn't the end. 4 or 6 or 8 years from now, South Carolina could be competitive again because it's got those same, you know, demographic changes happening on the ground, the diversifying population, the growing urban population that made Georgia competitive this year.
Instead, I'm curious your thoughts on that analysis, because we mentioned Jamie Harrison, and there was a huge amount of money that, particularly after the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, that was funneled into a lot of the Democratic senator races, particularly supporting Black candidates. And that had mixed reviews. This $90 million price tag that Brandon is describing for these two races and Stacey Abrams's fight, that looks like it's going to just keep requiring more money to win. Do you see that there are people who are going to stay motivated to continue to donate that type of money to these campaigns going forward? Or was this sort of a one-shot deal because of the president being who he was in office?
I think there's an open question about what level of motivation Democrats will have without kind of the villain of Trump there. Certainly the kind of money we saw this year, not just in the Senate race, but think about in South Carolina with the Jamie Harrison race. Think about the Kentucky race with Amy McGrath and Mitch McConnell, races that were always long shots for Democrats, but were raising historic sums of money. We don't know whether the party's base will continue to be motivated on that front, but we do think that there are some lessons that the National Party has taken from this cycle, like earlier investment in those organizers. And there's some lessons that aren't from the party, but from foundations and other groups who were slow to invest in many of the organizers in Georgia who saw the changes in the state coming a long time ago. There will be, and there already is, better investment from those groups in Texas, in places like South Carolina, and trying to shift the power base of the party away from the formal traditional organizers and more to that kind of grassroots level. I think that will continue, even if it's open to question whether the kind of campaign money will.
I was just going to say, I mean, were Ossoff and Warnock, did they motivate the voters enough on their own, or was this really a rebuke of President Trump? And Noah, I'll give you the last word on that. We've got about a minute left.
Definitely just want to say that money alone is not nearly enough. As folks mentioned, Amy McGrath's race, there was a ridiculous amount of money put in that race, and it was still a very disappointing outcome. So you do see a huge motivation by actual people on the ground who have been doing this work, regardless of whether the Democratic Party or national funders are paying attention. And we will continue to see a shift, because folks don't want to come back to this moment we're in right now ever again. And how we do that is to have the continued organizing, investment, and support that we have seen from organizations like the New Georgia Project, Fair Fight, Black Voters Matter, Asian Americans Advancing Justice, Georgia Coalition for People's Agenda, and in places like Mississippi Votes, in Louisiana, the Power Coalition for Equity and Justice. I mean, you have so many folks doing this work all across the South that is just something that people just need to have that value if we don't want to come back to this moment we're in right now.
Anoa Changa is the host of the politics podcast, The Way with Anoa. Brandon Miller is a Democratic Party strategist and a partner at Chisholm Strategies, a political consulting firm in Mississippi. And Ested Herndon is a national political reporter with The New York Times. Anoa, Ested, Brandon, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, great to be with you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for having me.
And our listeners in the South have been talking to us about this, too.
I'm currently living in South Carolina. Before here, I lived in Missouri. Since moving here and with everything going on at the protests and seeing how our government is reacting to people with different skin color, my views have definitely changed, because it's obvious that in the America we live in today, it only benefits you if you look like me, if you look white. I've realized that there's systems set up in our country that never wanted Black people to win.
This is Jeff from Gainesville, Florida. Since the mid-60s, I've had a very negative image of the South. After having read about the racial inequities and harsh treatment of Blacks and seen the horrifying photos of police brutality and lynchings. Throughout life, I have gained a more nuanced view of the South, but still feel a prejudiced disdain for the inequities here. So, following retirement, I work in my community in several ways to contribute to change.
My name is Robin. I live in South Florida. All my adult life, I have been a fiscal Republican and a social Democrat. Now, everything is very different. Democrats have moved way left, a little bit too left for me socially. And Republicans, I do not even recognize the party anymore. I will never, ever vote for a Republican again for the rest of my life.
Well, my personal political leanings haven't changed, and I remain a liberal Southern woman. What most certainly has changed is my awareness and understanding of the unwillingness on both sides to engage in civil political discourse. The perceived need to cling to our political beliefs, whether based in fact or social media-based altered realities, supersedes our moral codes, our faiths, our very foundations as Americans.
I'm from Alabama and I live in Florida now. I grew up a Republican. I've changed my views. Once they elected Barack Obama, I started realizing the Republican Party was just a bunch of racists. I really want to teach my kids that. I swapped over to Democrat because there's really not a whole lot of choices.
Hi, I'm Janice, a lifelong Southerner. And although I was a high school student in 1963 Birmingham, I never actually witnessed the race riots. But I knew something was terribly wrong with how blacks were being treated. My beliefs were shared by a very tiny group of high school peers. My family was very racist, but somehow I developed what would now be called a progressive mindset. And it has only become stronger over time.
Even though I grew up in Southwest Arkansas and was raised in a conservative evangelical tradition, I've always considered myself politically neutral. I voted for Bill Clinton twice and then George W. Bush in 2000. However, in the past decade or so, I've watched as those in power on the right have lied to and manipulated the poor and less educated to vote and speak against their own self-interests on things like health care. They've done this by using emotional wedge issues that most in the GOP leadership don't really care anything about. The Republican leaders at the federal level climb on the backs of the poor to grab and keep power. Add to that the past 4 years of cowardice on the side of the GOP, failing to stand up to Trump on anything, with the exception of John McCain, and I don't see how I could ever vote Republican again.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.